Welcome to the Brass Spittoon, the podcast of the Front Porch Republic. We'll chew on issues timeless and timely, with a focus on place, limits, and liberty. I'm your host, John Murdoch. Tim Carney is a happy warrior against the evils of alienation. Pull up a chair, as today we talk diapers and demography. And I will apologize in advance for the sometimes CB radio-like quality of my audio. The host blames the sound engineer, and the sound engineer blames the host. Both, of course, are the same person. Thankfully, our guest audio is much better, and you'll enjoy hearing what he has to say. My guest today is Timothy Carney. Tim, welcome to the Brass Spittoon at the Front Porch Republic.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You are a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and you write a column at the Washington Examiner. For today's purposes, it is important that you are a father of six, and you are the author of several books, including most recently, Family Unfriendly, How Our Culture Made Raising Kids Much Harder Than It Needs to Be. Again, welcome to the porch.
Thanks again. I've been a long time fan of Front Porch Republic, so it's good to be here.
Good to hear. Well, as a longtime fan, you may know that we're celebrating our 15th anniversary about this time, and all of that time, one of the sayings around the porch has been that we are dreaming of one day having a shoestring budget, and another saying is that we don't normally ride the news cycle. So you are something of an exception here, because you are in the midst. You are the news cycle right now. You have been everywhere. We're happy to have you here. We'll try to give you some questions that maybe you haven't heard before, so it's not just lather, rinse, repeat. And the first of those is the question that we give to all of our guests, and one I think you can have some fun with. What does home mean to you?
So it's funny, you mentioned my six kids, but when I was pondering this question, I realized the other day I came home while my son was walking the dogs, and it felt really weird to walk in the house and not be mauled by these two little hounds. And I realized that the two creatures that are always in my house, basically, are my dogs. So we have a very lively home. Six kids, my wife, me, and two dogs. And so it means aliveness. Sorry, my son is right now, as we speak, delivering a cup of coffee to me. Thank you, Brendan. So yes, life.
They double his staff. This is great.
So it definitely means life. These two main species being humans and dogs, but it's, we've had to move a couple times in the last few years, and we'll be moving again in a year. So the bricks and mortar have been changing. The books on the bookcase are the same, and the kids certainly are not the same. They keep getting bigger, but certainly alive and never quiet.
Well, before we get into your latest work, I did want to touch on your previous book, which was Alienated America. And I thought it was one of the best Trump explainer books that came out. One of the takeaways I brought from it was that, and you were looking primarily at the 2016 primaries, and you noted that Trump did worst among Christians who went to church the most. And in January, you did a follow-up piece looking back on those trends. And what did you find?
Well, it's still, you know, how sociologists and statisticians, they try to break out numbers. And so this can get confusing for a lot of people. The bottom line is, from a high altitude, you would see religious Christians tend to be Trump supporters. But a lot of that is simply attributed to the fact that conservatives tend to be Republicans and Trump has been the Republican nominee. If you were to, again, among fairly conservative people, break it down into churchgoers and non-churchgoers, it's still generally true that Trump is weakest among those who go to church the most. It's dramatically changed in the last 8 years, obviously. Trump won over a lot of religious conservatives with his appointees to the Supreme Court and all of that. But what you but I use the church attendance almost as just an alienated America, et cetera, as a proxy for a way to measure belonging among those who aren't in the upper class. So for middle class and working class Americans, if they belong to something, usually it's a church. And that's true in all of American history. And the elites in America who have fallen away from church, they're not belonging to nothing. They're not, you know, just swimming in their vats of gold behind their gated communities. They belong to an alumni association, professional networks, country clubs, and they're frankly the people who coach the Little League and that sort of thing. But for the working class and the middle class, belonging has traditionally meant church. So the thesis that was demonstrated, I thought, really clearly in Alienated America, with clear electoral numbers, still exists, but under the surface, which is that Trump is the guy who speaks for the those who think the American dream is dead. And basically that means the people who are less likely to have a community that they really feel they belong to.
And as you noted, and as you say in that January piece, there are still trends of resistance to Trump among the most religious, the most connected. But as you say, the baseline has changed. I count myself among those who is disappointed that the baseline has changed to the extent that it has. My hope was that faithfulness, those would be seeds of that would flower into a lovely sanity. But instead, it seems like that it's just become the compost for the poison ivy of the MAGA movement. Now, I raise that just to, as a segue into your current book, where the role of religion is very important. Even before reading your book, if I would see a large family in a big, what I would call a maxi van, not a minivan, right? A maxi van, 15 passenger van with no clear clothing cues, I would think Mormon, Catholic, or Quiverful.
We call those vans the Catholic assault vehicles. In my
right, you personally are in the Catholic category, and you've looked at several of these groups and others that also would have large families, Orthodox Jews. So, tell me a little bit about the role of religion in large family formation.
So, your observation is 100% correct. So the birth rate in the U.S. is low, down to 1.6, 1.7. Among those who regularly attend, whatever, you know, regardless of religion, it's well above 2, well above the replacement level. And if you were to find, if you could find for me, I'll put this challenge out to your listeners, a married couple with more than 4 kids who is not a regular church goer, synagogue goer, mosque attendee, I will send them both the person who finds them and the family a signed copy of my book. Quintuplets do not count. They've got to be at least 3 different births. Okay.
No IVF gone well. No,
exactly. And so that's definitely sort of the facts on the ground. The reason why, one of the great things about writing Family Unfriendly was I just had an excuse to read all these sociology studies, as well as to travel to places like Utah or to Orthodox Jewish neighborhoods, to Israel, and to interview all sorts of families. And one woman just said, for some of us, this is in Kemp Mill, modern Orthodox Jewish neighborhood is how I describe it in Maryland. She said, for some of us, 5 is just what you do. And so that's the most proximate cause, was she lived in a neighborhood and belonged to a religious community where 5 was normal. A woman, a demographer in Utah named Natalie Gotchnauer, she pointed out to me that the Catholics with the most babies in America are the Catholics in Utah. And so she said it's in the air. So one of my subsections...
Got to keep up with the Mormons, right?
Yeah, so one of my subsections is pregnancy is contagious. So right now I'm starting kind of on the ground level of why certain groups might have more kids. But also, if you go to Utah, if you go to BYU or BYU Idaho, these Mormon schools, if you go to the sort of kind of official events that my social circle through these Catholic schools goes to, if you go to Israel, if you go to Kent Mill, you will see visible accommodations of families. You will see the sign that says the price is $10 a person, $20 a family. You will see, as one guy put it, the bus drivers in Israel have a real affection for little kids. You will see more free-range kids. So parents who find that 8 kids is not that much harder than 2, because the older ones are taking care and all of them are running sort of free. You will see at BYU, it's normal for a student running late to class to hand off his stroller with his newborn to somebody else who's sitting and studying in the student union right off of the classroom hallways. And so all of those accommodations for families, those are more present in religious communities. So then you go a little bit higher in altitude. And I think here you find values. Now, I always apologize to any pastors who may be listening, but the homilies and the lectures on be fruitful and multiply, or in the Catholic Church, not that we ever get homilies or lectures about contraception, but the point is, it's not the teachings that make the difference, the specific teachings, as much, I believe, as the general values, the belief in life, the belief that you shouldn't and can't try to plan every detail in your life. Sort of something about a faith in providence makes you more likely to do crazy stuff like have 8 kids. And all of those values definitely get passed down. And I do believe that in religious circles, there's a little less of the sort of bitterly clinging to the hope that we can maximize our worldly achievement. And so for those sort of almost more abstract philosophical rather than theological views, I think religion conveys that you should value family because it's fun and it's what really matters in the long run.
So we started with talking about the things that make for a family-friendly atmosphere, religion being a big part of that. But your book is about a culture that, one, is not generally that religious, and partly as a result has created a family-unfriendly atmosphere. So how has that been done? Here's your softball. What's the book about?
So first, the evidence that it's a family-friendly culture, family-unfriendly culture. One is the epidemic of childhood anxiety. Children are just more anxious. Two is the just parents constantly reporting stress, looking for ways to relieve their stress, complaining about it, etc. And number three is a record low birth rates. 1.6 to 1.7 is a total fertility rate. That's the number of babies a woman will have in her lifetime. The number of babies born has fallen every year since 2007, from 4.3 million in the U.S. down to about 3.6 million. And it's still on its way down. So what has caused this? Now, some people would say it's just economics, but economics is part of it. Home affordability is definitely part of it. But in general, millennials are not poorer than Gen X was.
I found that an interesting point you made. For all the whining about, oh, our student loans, all this and that, you're saying when you adjust for inflation, there's not a major wealth gap.
Certainly. And then, but they feel poorer. And here's an important point. There was one millennial journalist who, when he was expecting, his wife was expecting their first baby, and he did this post on Twitter that there's a standard sort of formula for some posts that's two parts. Step one, step two. His step one was researches the cost of a night nurse. This is somebody you can hire to like take care of the baby while you and your wife sleep. So researches the cost of a night nurse. Step two, researches how to bring about a socialist revolution.
Okay.
The only way he could imagine dealing with children was through buying sleep through the market or through the state. The idea of doing it as a family, doing it with extended family, relying on neighbors and community, this hadn't occurred to this guy. And this was part of what I argued in Alienated America, right? Is that the just the very concept of civil society being a central part of your life and a source of aid doesn't occur to a lot of people in a more alienated society. And so if you do have to pay for every single hour of childcare and it's never provided by your mother-in-law, by your next door neighbor, by a nearby playground when they're five and you can walk away and leave them there with other kids and adults, then it does certainly feel more expensive. And so that's sort of my way of segueing from the cost to the culture. It actually does take a village to raise a child. We're not supposed to do it just mom and dad alone. We're supposed to have help. And then you throw onto that all the new challenges presented by tech, by smartphones and the apps, how the dating apps are making it less likely that adults ever get married in their 20s, dating apps and other cultural changes. So the culture is broken from parenting culture, which is too intensive, dating culture, and the culture's values. In all of these ways, they are making it harder for parents and making it seem harder than it even is.
And you mentioned that phrase, it takes a village. That's one that appears a lot in this book and in your previous book as well. I recall from my days in D.C. a story of then-Senators Rick Santorum and Hillary Clinton that would have kind of a friendly back and forth as they saw each other in the hallways. She had written, of course, the famous book, It Takes a Village to Raise a Child. He had written a less famous book, I think it's called It Takes a Family. So they would see each other and he would say, it takes a family, and she would say, it takes a village. I think what you're saying is it takes both, but village means village, and it doesn't just mean government-subsidized daycare.
Yeah, so you mean lots of things when you say village. There's an anthropological understanding of village, which means extended family and cousins, and I go on at length about that in this book. Hillary probably meant the Department of Health and Human Services when she said the village, but certainly it means next door neighbors and it means belonging to stuff. I mean, so the first couple chapters I try to push parents away from putting their kids in super intensive travel sports and helicoptering and worrying about them scraping their knees or getting abducted or whatever. But when somebody says, what's one thing that a parent can do to make it easier? I say, immerse yourself. Throw you and your whole family into a church community or something like that. Like, just show up, volunteer, do everything. Make it be the sort of thing that you call we. When I talk about my parish, St. James, I say we. When I talk about my kids' schools, I call them all we. When I talk about, you know, the state of Virginia, I've only lived here for a year. I don't call Virginia we. I don't think when I'm paying my taxes, the money is just going back to a big us, right? It's some abstract entity.
But scale last night matters.
Last night when we were at the fish fry at St. James, there was some confusion. Well, one of our kids is volunteering. Does he get to eat for free? I'm basically just going to eat my kids' leftovers. Should we pay for that? I was just throw the money in the basket. It's going to us, okay? Like, we're not going to negotiate a lower price Friday night fish fry. And so if you have a we, that's the single best thing. A we that's pro-family, something you really belong to. That's the single best thing to make family life easier. And so the alienation I discussed in the last book is the – not only is it the most important cause of our family-unfriendly culture, but the reason I wrote the book is because I thought that the reduction in the birth rates, the aversion to starting families, and the sort of anxiety of modern childhood, that's the most important consequence of the collapse of civil society.
You mentioned something that I found interesting, and I've called it the Laffer curve of parenting. And of course, the Laffer curve is the idea that at some point on the spectrum, lower taxes equals more revenues. You have the similarly counterintuitive argument that more kids equals less stress for the parents. How does that work?
Yes. So first off, I don't know anybody who was not helicoptery and, you know, overly doting on their first. That's just natural. Basically, every family of of every parent of big families will tell the story laughingly about what they did for the first child that they now find absurd. Like buying the wiper warmer to make sure that when you wipe their butts, it's not a cold baby wipe.
I've heard the pacifier thing, right? I mean, the first one, you boil it, and then the second one, you wash it off, and the third one, you give it to the dog to lick. Right?
Yes. Oh, even owning a changing table. I think the Twitter account Smug Fecundity, which is my favorite small follower pseudonymous account, he told he said, "This is our changing table," and it was a dresser with like a some sort of cushion from a former couch or something like that on top of it. And we did have a diaper pail that lasted all six kids. I wanted to bronze it once we finally realized we had graduated out of diapers. But so the first, you're always going to be overly doting or neurotic about the first one. And then the subsequent ones, you've learned what doesn't matter. You know, in our case, when we had child number four, our oldest would have been, I'm doing some rough math here, about seven, six. And so she was able to do stuff. It's key to have a girl first, I will say. But she was able to do stuff and help out, certainly to entertain her younger siblings. And, you know, to return the pacifier, to return the dropped baby bottle. And even, you know, even to change a diaper, certainly when she got to be nine. And so you get the help from the older siblings. You learn to chill. And then when our oldest was doing ballet, because somebody had said, oh, Maryland Youth Ballet, it's the best program. So we signed her up. I mean, we live a short drive from the best program. How could we not do it? We realized it was a great mistake. And number two, he played travel baseball, and that proved to be a mistake. And since then, we haven't done the best program of anything or a travel anything. And so learning from your mistakes is a big part of it. And it just becoming impossible to try to do that. But I can't emphasize enough how key it is to have them just running around and entertaining one another. That unstructured, unsupervised play for kids is one of the key things that's missing.
So I thought of your book, Alienated America, as an anecdotal, on-the-scene version of Charles Murray's Coming Apart, where he builds the upper-class Belmont and the lower-class Fishtown. Your latest book, Family Unfriendly, seems very much a Belmont book, written from Belmont to Belmont parents, telling them to chill out. How do you think it's applicable to Fishtown? Very fractured families. You know, there are going to be multiple partners involved. It's a different world.
There was a dichotomy I would make when talking about Alienated America that applies here, which is to say the same problem exists and it manifests itself in different forms. So the problem of low birth rate, let's just talk on that. The root of elite collapsing birth rate is education that never ends. And so marriage that gets delayed, combined with this anxiety that leads to high intensity, maximum effort parenting. In the working class, it is true that all cultural trends tend to trickle down. And so like overambitious parenting, when we did a focus group of guys who didn't have children and were undecided, a lot of these guys were working class guys who just said, I want to be in a position where I can give my child the absolute best of everything before I start having children. And so this was a working class guy, wasn't married. But that was the attitude he had adopted. But the most important reason for lower birth rates and probably for childhood anxiety in the working class is going to be the lack of stable marriages. And so more people having babies before they get married, having babies with multiple partners, divorce happening. My wife and I, we joined along with Bethany Mandel, who's a conservative writer, Jewish mother of six. We joined this Facebook group called Big Family Tricks of the Trade. And a lot of it was about like, which is the best large, you know, hotel shuttle van to buy for your kids? Or what's the best large capacity washing machine?
Speed Queen, right?
Speed Queen is the answer. And if you know any Mormons, they will tell you about that. A lot of the posts were about like, how do you deal with the fact that the ex-husband wants to come over on Thanksgiving? Like we realized that the large family tricks of the trade Facebook group was not the monogamously married church-going people who were in our circles. And so it is a different world. I think a lot of the causes are, you know, the proximate causes are different, but some of the underlying causes are the same. I think social media and that sort of stuff is more destructive of the families in the working class than in the upper class. You know, famously, Palo Alto parents don't let their kids have iPhones because they're the ones who design them to be addictive. And the medium is the message, they say, and the medium of the message of social media is to tear people away from their environment. Upper class families are more like, I mean, we send our kids to a Catholic school that is very explicit about resisting smartphones for kids, certainly social media. The average elementary school, I mean, middle or high school in America is apt to almost mandate that the kids have it. So that idea that iPhones and that sort of stuff is a rich person's thing.
Thou shalt learn by looking at a screen.
Yeah. And that's much more true the further down the income scale you go. And some people will assume it's the opposite. But so some of those problems that I identify in the book definitely are at the root of some of the working class problems. But ultimately, you're right. I didn't write a book about divorce and out of wedlock births. But I did write a book, I think, about the general cultural trends away from belonging and religion, both leading to these problems for children and the problem of fewer children.
And you started that answer with the thesis that these things trickle down. And I think you made a good point that certainly from a marketing standpoint, a lot of things trickle down. But I mean, Murray famously says, you know, the upper class don't preach what they practice. Right. And so a lot of these things don't trickle down or are not put out as positive values. And you talk a lot about the problem of our hyper autonomy as the goal.
Yeah. So that, I mean, that's certainly, well, and I did do this in the end of Alienated America, the thinking on the last chapter of Alienated, last two chapters that led to becoming Family and Friendly was the elites in America tending to follow what, you know, my colleagues at AEI will call the success sequence. You finish school, whether it's high school or college, you get a job, you get married, and then you have kids. You don't mess up that order and you don't skip any of those first three steps. And so that is very bourgeois, very conservative sounding, especially the idea that you get married or monogamous, have kids, dedicate yourself to your local community, coach Little League. It's very, you know, leave it to beavery. But that's the way the upper class, the people who edit all the magazines that are on the newsstands, et cetera, that's the way they all live their life. And they tend to be increasingly politically liberal, but in their day-to-day life, they're conservatives. Now, part of the problem, though, is what in Alienated America, I called it an infertile virtue. What they were preaching to their kids was overlapped with what I would call virtue, but it was just best practices for them. There wasn't a good reason to, you know, be married in a lasting relationship.
Your lifetime income will be higher. That was the extent of it.
Exactly. Yes. You could see the charts on how much better off you'll be if you follow these rules. And that's a harder thing to pass down. It's certainly not something you're going to feel comfortable preaching as what others ought to do. It ends up being, hey, you know, this is what works for us. But I do think that what has trickled down again is this belief that parenting, because it's exquisitely chosen, it's postponed, it's agonized over. And then as part of it, living intentionally, we intentionally chose at this moment to have a kid. That makes the whole process so much more burdensome. And I think that thinking has trickled down to the middle and working classes.
So let me turn to a couple porchy topics. You mentioned that you have bounced around, your brick and mortar has changed, but in the book, you describe your dream home.
Definitely, because I was describing how, you know, not everybody gets exactly what they want in their life. For instance, I want a giant wraparound porch on my house with the idea of me sitting on the front porch while the kids play on the lawn and I wave to the neighbor. I have failed so far to get that. I will fail for the rest of my life to get that. I do have a little kind of my last house, the front porch, just to make it very porchy, we lived in like a house behind houses. So we were, you could barely see
like
the
a flag
street.
Lot.
So we literally, a flag lot, yes. 210 feet was my driveway. I knew that because I had to shovel it a lot. And so only our next door neighbors could we see. It meant that my dogs could sit on the front porch without having to be leashed because there was like no neighborhood dogs for them to chase after. It also meant eventually my next door neighbor got to love my dog, especially when my dog killed their the groundhogs. Oh,
okay. I wasn't sure where that was going for a second.
Killed her husband. No, killed her groundhogs. But now we're on a sort of a second tier, a street that is just big enough to have two yellow lines down the middle. And so the downside is like the kids, you know, they can't throw a football around the street. It's a little busier. Not everybody stops at the stop sign, but it is on the way to church. And so when we finally moved in, somebody said, Carney, do you live on Birch Road? I said, yeah. He says, I know which house is yours. I said, oh, were my kids out front playing? He goes, I don't know what your kids look like, but there was a statue of the Virgin Mary and two cornhole boards with the Mets logo on them. And I figured that had to be your house. And so there is something nice about that. And one day I was just, you know, taking out the trash, and a friend who had dropped his kids off at the Catholic school was like, hey, I'm going to come in for coffee. And he just invited himself in, and that was good. So that's the upside of living on a street that's a little bit of a thoroughfare. We do have a front porch. It doesn't have a fence, so our dogs can't sit out there. So that makes it a little sad. If we had better trained dogs, they could. But also, we don't have a backyard. And so I will tell you how many neighbors, when they meet me and I say I have six kids, they say, oh, you guys have the wiffle ball house. Because our kids have to play wiffle ball in the front yard, and that cheers the neighbors.
Well, related to this idea of construction matters, the front porch has largely been replaced in most suburbs by the garage. We've had in the past Chuck Marone from Strong Towns, who is a big critic of what he calls the strode, the street road combo, which he describes as the futon of transportation, right? It does neither thing well. There's the culture bucket in your book. There's also the policy bucket. And one of those policies is town planning.
Yeah, chapter 3 is titled, If You Want Fecundity in the Sheets, You Need Walkability in the Streets. In Washington, D.C., there's a lot of YIMBYs, a lot of new urbanists. And one of my friends said, they seem to think social policy should center around their own ability to walk to a really good cocktail bar. And my walkability that I focus on, borrowing a term from a friend of mine who has no interest in going to cocktail bars or coffee shops or whatever, but really wants his kids to have a relatively free-range childhood, is kid walkability, kid bikeability. So maybe dad does have to commute to work. Maybe, you know, you can't get to, even if there's not a great downtown, there's at least like, you know, a corner store there. There are parks, there are playgrounds. Frankly, there are sidewalks. I was amazed. As a New Yorker, we had sidewalks everywhere in the city, in the suburbs. In Maryland and Virginia, I don't have a sidewalk in front of my house. My old block in Maryland, I complained there was a creek a mile away. It was heaven for kids to run around that creek all summer, but there was no sidewalk on the mile walk to the creek. You basically had to either take a detour or walk in the road. And so people will ask you in DC on these podcasts, they say, what's the number one policy you would propose? And some thinks it would be subsidized childcare. Some thinks it would be a larger tax credit, yada, yada. I say it would just be better sidewalks, crosswalks, playgrounds, bike trails. And this involves trade-offs, right? In Maryland, there was a neighborhood where this woman complained that her cherry trees would die if a sidewalk was put in. And somebody said, well, my kid needs to be able to walk to school, not in the road. And she said, your kids shouldn't be walking to school alone anyway. This is like sixth graders. And so also there would be trade-offs in that cars would have to go slower. I'm just looking out my window right now. Two guys just blew right through the stop sign because they think the stop sign's pointless and they're going 40. If you made roads narrower so that it was easy for kids to cross, cars would have to go slower. And that would be the point right for people like me who want our kids riding their bikes around the neighborhood. But it would be absolute oppression. And the people who get upset about this mostly are the people who I would think of as my political allies. These are conservatives. But the freedom of the car is something that so many people hold so dearly that the idea of the freedom of a childhood sometimes gets forgotten.
Yeah, you describe it as car hell. You don't hold back.
Well, yeah. So us as parents having to do this, I mean, because again, you can never, ever, ever leave any of your children in a car for 15 seconds unattended. And you're cutting up your hands and getting like a slurry of butt sweat and goldfish shoved into your wounds. And yeah, that you can't go shopping without them. So right now we can basically walk to one thing, which is local church in my kid's school. And it's just that is enough to make us happy. And we're renting and to want to stick around here. But man, if our kids could, again, walk to the corner store, that would be great. And there's a few friends they can walk to, but these sort of things seem so little. And then once you're a parent, you realize, wait a second, if they have to be driven everywhere they go, then, and they don't have their driver's license yet, I'm the one who's doing it. And it makes life a lot less fun for parent and kid. And it's all about the built environment together with the norms of, is it okay to let your kids run around? One of my friends, his oldest is 9, and he said, neighbors have complained that their kids are running up and down the sidewalk unattended, not crossing the street, literally running up and down. They're on a real long block in DC, running up and down the sidewalk, and that freaks out the neighbors because they're sure that they'll be abducted by well-trained kidnappers with getaway vehicles ready.
Right. Yeah, a lot of the book is about a realistic risk analysis for these things that we have greatly freaked out over. You're talking about commuting, you're talking about work, you're talking about the need to have things close by. Last year, Nancy Piercy had a cover story at Touchstone, and I just found this fascinating that her thesis is basically that what broke the family was not women leaving the home for work, but men. And this idea of the loss of a household mm-hmm. income, a household economy. And of course, at Front Porch Republic, a lot of us have an affection for Wendell Berry, and the idea of having a farm with a riding shed or a wood shop is kind of is the utopia.
If any of your listeners are selling one of those for a reasonable price, have them give me a call. The removal of productive paid work from the house or, the et cetera, does create this problem, especially when you combine it with the fact that we generally value gender equality. And so you could tell a story of, okay, so the work leaves the house, and then years later people say, well, women need to have equal access to this education and this work. Right now the college graduating classes are majority female, master's degrees mm-hmm. majority female, I think PhDs too, I'm not sure on that one, but the pay is by a lot of measures not ultimately equal, and the upper echelons of corporate life certainly dominated by men. Why is that? So you dig into that, you realize, well, it does have to do with preferences. Women, mothers want flexibility more than men do. They want to be able to spend more time with their kids. And if you get compensated in flexibility, you get less compensated in pay and promotion. And so one of the later chapters, I discuss that an approach to solving this was national daycare. This happens in Northern Europe, et cetera. And if you think about what this implication is, oh, the reason we don't have equality is because parents are expected to take care of their kids, and that disproportionately goes to women. So if we remove kids from even the people who have kids, then everybody will just be good workers and we'll have more equality. I don't have to convince you or your audience how perverse and inhumane that is, but that's really the thinking of a lot of American commentators and Northern European governments. And so this is the problem. If money is going to be made outside the home and you don't change human nature, so women, mothers are going to disproportionately be taking care of their kids, especially when they're young, you're going to have this economic inequality. And to some extent, you can just live with that. And what allows you to live with that is marriage and monogamy and social norms binding the husband who has the income and the skills to the wife who's made herself more vulnerable. Not an optimal situation from the Nancy Piercy, Wendell Berry perspective. But one of the things I try to add on top of that, given the reality of we're going to leave the house to make money, or at least have an employer or start a business, is a family-friendly feminism that A, values homemaking more than is currently valued. And there's some tweaks to the law, you could do that. But B, in the workplace, for dads to, just in the workplace, not at home. Dads shouldn't act like moms at home. Dads should act like dads. But in the workplace, to act like moms in that they stand up and say, hey, I got to go. My family needs me. Thursday, can we have this meeting? Not Thursday night. Thursday night is the opening night of my son's play. I'm going to be there. Hey, Saturday night, can you come out? No, Saturday night. I remember I got asked to go on MSNBC once. Almost said yes, except then replied, no, tonight I'm finally showing my kids Empire Strikes Back. And I'm not going to let them watch this and have that moment.
Luke.
Where they learn about yet without my being there. And it was great. It was a great moment. Sadly, the younger kids had it spoiled before they could ever understand. But when I replied that to the MSNBC producer, she at first thought I was joking and then thought it was the best reply she had ever gotten. And so doing that and just like openly, almost obnoxiously saying, hey, my family is coming first. And then as a boss to say that and to show it with your values as an employer, that's the way I can handle it. Is that living within a broken, fallen world that's suboptimal compared to domestic production all being unified? Yes. So I'm not that revolutionary, I guess. My Wendell Berry sits on my shelf, I guess, rather than controlling where I buy my homestead.
In this hybrid world that we live in, this it's certainly not ideal. What do you think the role of post-COVID teleworking is? Is this a good thing or is this a bad thing? Is this bringing us back or is this a new distraction in the home that's a problem?
It's definitely mixed. I think all of us have found it trouble hard to turn off. And on a you know, Thursday night at 7 p.m., getting onto work and checking things out. So all of that, blurring the lines can be negative. What young parents need, though, is flexibility, especially, you know, if they're not blessed with a single income that can pay the bills, then one of the things I advocate in the book is developing more new parent jobs, new mom jobs of transitioning, I think, in journalism, a reporter who's like going to Capitol Hill every day, transition her to an editor that edits outside submissions, sort of thing that can be done at her pace from home, rarely has to come into the office. She can time it for when the children are napping or asleep or husband comes home from work. So it's not super time sensitive. That certain jobs like that can alleviate that pressure would be part of it. But also just an advantage of being a man is that if no matter what I do, I get cheered. Oh, Tim really takes his career seriously. That's great. Oh, Tim, he leaves work early to take care of the kids. That's great. This one study I read, women who were leaving to go home to their family were pretending that they were leaving to go to a client. There were some men who were leaving to go to a client and were pretending they were leaving to go home to their family. But the women felt that somehow they would be seen as shirkers, specifically if they were taking care of the family. And so that's the attitude that, again, I think employers have to be the ones to shift that attitude.
I think we'll shift to the friendly pushback section of the interview. So to set this up, we're having an interesting conversation here because I'm the 50-year-old unmarried, childless, single guy. I say I am childless by choices, some of the bad choices I made and then some choices that were thrust upon me. But a lot of people in my generation and younger are actually childless by choice. They are affirmatively do not want this. One issue that they would point to is, hey, there are some real environmental problems here. I'm hoping to have Bill McKibben on the podcast soon, and he wrote a book now 25 years ago called Maybe One, The Case for Smaller Families. So let's have a little virtual dialogue going on here. Why is Bill wrong? How should that impact your plans for the size of your family?
So the climate worries take two forms that sometimes get blended. One is, I don't want to bring kids into a world that's on fire. and is literally melting. And two is every child is, whatever, 50 million tons of carbon dioxide emissions. And so children, so humans are harming the planet, so we shouldn't have more of them. The first one in the book, I turn to Ezra Klein, who says, like, look, this is sort of fear that's a cover story for guilt. We're going to adapt in our lifetime, in our kids' lifetime, especially anybody who might be listening to this, reading this, most likely lives in the developed world and not on a coral reef island that's right at sea level. But on the are we destroying the planet question, I have a couple answers. One is right now, actually, humans are taking up less and less land every year. Peak agricultural land, particularly farming and grazing land, if you add those two together, those peaked 20 years ago, and they're generally going down. And so just that, our physical footprint, what percentage of the planet are we taking up, is actually shrinking because agricultural land is shrinking. Our living land isn't growing as rapidly. The other thing I would say is humans are good, and human quality of life has improved. If you look on like a long term, you know how graphs can sometimes smooth it, a 3-year rolling average, take a 300-year rolling average, and it's generally an upward, a straight up line from when humans came on this earth for us. Right. And humans, and the cause of that is us. And so then the question is, should I care about
what about the tiger,
tree frogs and the tigers and the dodo birds? We obviously have an obligation to care for them. And I guess eventually there comes down to a values different. I value a single human over every tiger in the world.
Every tiger?
Every tiger. I think I have a Christian anthropology, and I think a human has infinite value. I think that to deliberately or carelessly harm a single tiger is wrong. Like, if my kid threw a baseball at a tiger, that would be a sin. I would scold him. I'd make him go to confession. But if human existence, we ought to make human existence more compatible with everything else on this planet, not just for our sake, but to be good caretakers of the planet. But that to say we should have fewer humans for the sake of some species, I think eventually there's just a ultimate values difference there.
Well, the call to be fruitful was a call that went out to all species. After the flood, God wants all species to flourish. Your book, you fall back a little bit on this idea. Well, you know, the experts say that our population is going to stabilize at 8 to 10 billion. And I think Bill, and to some extent myself, would say, that's not going to happen if people do what you want them to do. Right? If everybody's having 6 kids, we're not going to stabilize at 8 to 10 billion. Is there any number that worries you? Can we handle a trillion on the planet? Right? I mean, you've invoked the Julian Simon utopian vision of the human mind as the ultimate resource, but how does that mm-hmm. square with the fallenness of man and the fact that we often make big mistakes?
So, I mean, I like the intellectual undertaking of what, can we take a trillion people on the planet? But as a conservative, what I often see myself doing is pushing against what I see as a negative trend. So when I was writing Alienated America, people said, well, what about these communities that are so tight-knit that nobody has free expression, and, you know, or think about Sicily that's run by the mob and everything so family and community-oriented. And I said, if I lived in those places, I might be writing, right, you know, Stifling Sicily instead of Alienated America. If I lived at a time that 6 was the average birth rate, I don't think I would have written this book, especially if we didn't have the childhood anxiety problem. But that the underlying anthropology that ends up being anti-human is broadly negative, is what I would say. And higher birth rate in all cases is not always good, obviously. Christianity ended up reducing birth rates because it said you should have monogamous marriage, and that's where you have babies, and you should be able to take care of your babies, and women have the right to consent or refuse consent. And so that ended up being contraceptive in some ways compared to the time. But I would go back to Ehrlich's philosophy, and I treat him in the last two chapter, Paul Ehrlich, Population Bomb. It was anti-human.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
And I don't know Bill McKibben enough to say whether his, and that's, I mean, that's what I would ask if I were you, is to say,
and I will.
Are you, do you believe that humans are good? Do you, what would you say to somebody who's expecting, who says, I really want a second and a third child? I mean, I, can they articulate a philosophy that also allows them to love their neighbor fully? That's a challenge for the antinatalists, I think. And I don't describe myself as pronatalist, because Elon Musk is probably pronatalist. He's having kids outside of the whole monogamous marriage thing. I describe myself as pro-family. And I think that if you can come up with a pro-family mindset that would limit the population, that would be an interesting debate to have.
Every straight and narrow road has a ditch on each side. So I hear you that, you know, you push back against which guardrail is society grinding up against right now. You try to steer them back. And certainly I would agree with you that, I mean, a big problem is the anthropology, the fact that we have lost the idea of humans being created in the image of God. That is a big loss, and that has major implications here. I do think there is this balancing of that we have to, we do have to think about. We were called to be stewards of the entire planet. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of conservatives sort of drunk the Julian Simon Kool-Aid. It is all human focused. There is a religious-like belief that we will always solve the problem. I mean, point to the Green Revolution happened, so we didn't go off into that chasm. We built the bridge in time. And Simon and the Simonizers seem to believe we will always build the bridge in time. And I can't go there. I think the fallenness of human nature is also something that we have to take into account, and the big mistakes that we've made. So that's my rant. Anything on that?
No, I mean, I would just say absolutely that we do need to worry about our impact. For me, though, the numbers are, right, especially right now, one of the last worries. The technology we develop, how rapidly we deploy technology when we have no idea what it's doing. I mean, these days we think of artificial intelligence. We could also have thought of the automobile. That those are the things to worry about, as far as what are the unknown consequences. Because that's the other thing. As a conservative, and I always tell every climate change activist, like, it would be pretty easy to talk like a conservative. Just say radical changes to complex systems have unknown consequences, and unknown consequences tend to be bad. And that is...
Right, that's the Industrial Revolution. We're going to have this big experiment. We're going to convert all of this solid carbon into atmospheric carbon and just see what happens.
And I see the current radical change being well below replacement level birth rates. I mean, South Korea is the leading edge of this replacement. And I think that the social dynamics there is going to be pretty bad, and it's going to hit Europe, and it might or might not hit the US.
You mentioned South Korea. I lived in South Korea for a few years, and yes, the single child mindset. I mean, you know, South Korea went from a society that had like six was the average number of children, and they hammered and hammered on the you know, the message of reduce your kids, and it worked, and now it's worked too well. Among where I worked at a Christian law school, there were a couple of quiverful families that were walking around with their 6 to 10 children, and it was just fascinating to see. And the Koreans reacting and trying to figure out, can you do this still? Is it still even possible? Right. there's certainly a real problems. You highlight the problems of too few workers. You make those arguments. Let me ask you this. How does it not become a Ponzi scheme, right? How does it not become that argument that we always have to have more? I mean, I think to some extent what we're dealing with right now, I mean, there's too few. We have too many old people, not enough young people. But this is the python digesting the pig of the baby boom. Yes, it's going to have impacts, but I don't know if the answer is to eat a bigger pig.
Mm-hmm. So the problem of the old age dependency ratio, that's what the sort of antinatalist can argue is a painful transition. In fact, their argument resembles to me when I read sort of I don't know if you've ever read Austrian economists, but they sort of argue that what's needed to come, you know, that often we need less easy money and that we need austerity in order to just have like a painful, you know, the bitter pill to cure the disease. And that's what the antinatalist would say is, okay, yes, there would be a 40-year period when all the boomers are retiring and there's not enough people to work for them. But then if you held population stable or declining, it would be more gentle. I'd be more convinced by that if I thought that the birth rate was going to be, you know, like France's, like right below and kind of steady right below the replacement rate of 2.1. But instead, everybody who falls below it, with very few exceptions, seems to keep going down. And that a society with fewer children, that changes a culture. That's why culture is in the subtitle of the book. That changes a culture to become more family unfriendly. And again, in South Korea, there are multiple articles in different outlets. I think the New York Times and I think a British one about the rise in no children allowed signs in South Korea, because you go all day not seeing kids and then somebody brings their darn stinky loud kid into the coffee shop and suddenly you're more bugged by it. Well, if you're in Israel, that's the background noise of your daily life is the kids. If you're in my Catholic parish, that's the background noise of your daily life is all the kids. And you become more used to it. You build your society for kids. If you're Israel, you build your society forgetting about kids if you're one of these very low birth rate cultures. So that idea that we're our current family culture involves us spiraling down towards South Korea is one of the reasons that I'm not ready to sort of say, okay, let's just swallow the bitter pill of the, you know, or push the boomers off the cliff or push Gen X, you and me, off the cliff and make us work 90 hours a week to pay for the boomers' retirement. I don't think that sets up a stable future, you know, once the boomers are all gone.
Well, we'll call an end to the friendly pushback section and I'll end with the beginning of your book and something I think where we can agree, and that is sports are bad.
I think you misread that a little.
No, I exaggerate for effect, but I have a vivid but uncreditable memory of some documentary I saw on PBS about the anxieties of childhood, and it was a super zip family, you know, striving to get into the Ivy Leagues, and the teenage daughter participated in cross country, which she was not very good at, but she clearly enjoyed, she had a friend with her that ran and they would finish at the back of the pack. Her mom was just baffled by, why are you doing this? I think the kid just wanted an escape. But my guess is that you would think the kid is correct and the mom was wrong here. And that sports has a place, but it should not be every place.
So the first word of the preface and the first word of chapter one are both baseball. And so this is the Straussian secret meaning of the book is that that baseball is central to the good life and thus my wiffle ball front yard. But specifically, it's a game. And particularly for kids, it's a game. And when it becomes something else, when it becomes a ticket to college, when it becomes, you have to, why bother doing it if you're not going to be doing it just right? And when it becomes intensive, especially for kids, it breaks up family culture. I had a dad tell me when my book was coming out, he says, I hate the fact that the swim coach determines my family's schedule. When we have a family dinner, it's determined by Coach Williams and not by mom or dad. It becomes high stress for the kids. It makes them intensive rather than expansive, and this limits what they can learn during their childhood. And it makes it more stressful for the parents. So if you asked me to set up my perfect little community, it isn't just that the travel leagues would give way to the little league. It's that the organized sports would give way to the pickup sports. And that really, my favorite memories from a kid was not even playing baseball. I was playing pickup football and basketball with my friends. Rivalries that develop over 10 years. You're just thinking, if Johnny A scores the winning basket on me, I'm never going to sleep again. I will gnaw off my arm to block his shot. Those sort of rivalries, that was the best thing about childhood. And it was fun and it was a great learning experience. and what's happened to the professionalization of sports, as I put in the book, the logic of capitalism has seeped into our social arrangements, and particularly into our youth sports. And that's definitely destructive to childhood and to family life.
Well, we'll leave it there. My guess is you have a basketball game to play with your many kids right now. So, Tim Carney, it's been a pleasure. The book is Family Unfriendly, How Our Culture Made Raising Kids Much Harder Than It Needs to Be. Thanks so much for joining us on the porch.
Thank you.
Until next time, my thanks to you and yours for pulling up a chair.
Find your way home. Find your way home.